what kind of jobs would you like to see created in your district?
Well, interesting. Right now, I believe that there's more important than creating new jobs is making sure that we plug the hole in the boat and keep the old jobs from leaving. You know, we have a real problem going on here in Illinois, and I don't know that it's realistic to have a very short-term, short-range plan of saying, hey, we just need to create new. We haven't solved the issue of creating a stable environment for our existing employers to keep them from closing and keep them from leaving.
And how would what role would government have in doing that?
Well, I think that there's a couple of key components when we start talking about jobs. Right now, I honestly believe that most of these small business, medium businesses that I speak to are looking for stability and predictability in government. They want to know who's in charge. They want to know that they can count on whatever they've been told to believe in and that it's going to stay that way. We need to look and create a competitive environment for our businesses because right now at the rate that, you know, since the Quinn tax increase, the number of businesses that are leaving is, I mean, we're at an epidemic proportion right now. 80, 90, 100,000 jobs, are gone. And right now, the reason they're leaving is that we're just simply not competitive against other states, specifically Indiana, Wisconsin, and the number of people that I've spoken with that have left for Texas is simply incredible. The final thing that we need to look at is, do we have the raw resources here in Illinois, Chicagoland area? And the answer is we absolutely do. We've got a top-flight air system, I mean, with Midway and O'Hare. We've got a rail hub. You know, we have the lakefront. We have people wanting to work. They have the desire to work. So it's not a problem of resources. It's a situation of competitive environment and stability, predictability, bureaucracy in government.
Okay. And next, moving to education. What direction should the state follow to support K through 12 education?
Right now, I honestly believe that we have some absolutely wonderful teachers. We just have a system that rewards those teachers for longevity rather than performance. It's not child-based. It's not family-based anymore. It's all about how long have you been here and how long are you staying. And until we get that turned around, until we make it about performance expectations for our teachers based on the academics of our children, we're not going to hit the goals that we want. We're not going to be satisfied with this.
And what could the state do about educational structure here in Illinois and the support structure, including perhaps the regional superintendents?
Well, I think, and that regional superintendent's job, I want to be very honest with you, Sue. I am not a politician. I have not been exposed to the inner workings of everything. I do speak with the local superintendents. I have spent considerable time, speaking with teachers, speaking with the administration, speaking with the superintendent levels. I have not had the opportunity to speak with the regional superintendents and really fully understand what their role is in the big picture. You know, right now, the thing that the superintendents that I speak with, their job has become more of a financial juggling act than it is educating people, educating students. And right now, the best thing that we can do is get our financial house in order here in the state of Illinois so that these people can go back to worrying about bettering our students rather than worrying about, will the money be there from the state so we can pay our bills?
And moving to higher education, what do you see as the state's role in funding public education, college level and beyond?
Well, I think that we really need to evaluate what's going on at the higher education levels. I have a student that's a freshman. My own son is a freshman at the university this year. And I have to be honest with you, I was overwhelmed at the cost that these universities have risen to. And right now we need to seriously look and say, in this country, is a college education financially attainable for the average person? And I do understand that there, you know, there's exceptions to every rule, and there's ways to get things done. But when I interview and when I speak with some of these groups and find out that that these students at 21 years old are walking out with $80,000 in debt for an undergraduate degree, I don't know how we sustain that. And I understand that that University of Illinois is saying that, well, we didn't get our money from the state, so we have to raise tuition. It's the same death spiral, you know, that we've entered into in the business world, where we have too few people paying taxes that are too high. Well, in this case, we have tuition that's too high, and at some point, you know, we're not going to have the students that are going to be able to afford to get there. So, unfortunately, you know, it does boil back down to a financial issue at that level as well.
MAP grants have been talked about a lot in funding for higher education in Illinois, and the state, you know, that's part of the what the state does for higher education. It sounds like you might have some thoughts that we need to go beyond that too. What sort of ideas would you have for making college more affordable?
Well, I think that, again, we unfortunately need to look at things like, and this sounds so canned and so cliche, but when we look at the average cost of the student and where those costs come from, how many students do we have per classroom? What are the credentials that it takes to actually be a teacher at this certain level? In terms of the student housing, it's the entire package that we need to evaluate. It doesn't truly, in my opinion, it doesn't matter if we are looking at a competitive analysis, whether we're looking at it for a grade school, a high school, or at the college level. We need to find ways to evaluate this and say the all-around cost, call it spending, is so high that we are simply uncompetitive. And we can squeeze the balloon in any number of different ways to say, okay, if we do this, if we do that, hey, you know what? The bottom line is it just costs too much for the education. Where is it that we can cut back? Where can we compare ourselves to other universities, you know, across the country, and say, what is it that we can do? Honestly, for me, I this is paramount. I have a freshman right now in school. I have a junior in high school. I have an eighth grader going into high school next year. So I will be paying tuition for the next, you know, for the next 10 years. So this is paramount for me. When I look at this and then I look at the average family and say, how do we go about doing it? And there is no simple answer. There is no simple answer for this. And it's a matter of boiling it down and figuring out what exactly is the calculations that are being used now, and how can those calculations change, knowing that money is going to continue to be tighter, not in abundance, as we continue for the next at least 4 to 10 years.
Let's move to health insurance.
Okay.
What's your position on creating health insurance exchanges as in preparation for healthcare reform?
Tell me a little bit more. I am not familiar with the concept of healthcare exchanges.
Okay, it's it's being challenged in court in places too. But that would be where local groups could pool resources or actually exchange health or across state lines, or, you know, across country borders in some cases, you know, like an exchange with so people could join the exchange and then maybe get lower Canadian prices. Or
I don't think we're there yet. I think we're in a mess. I think that the current structure that's been placed in front of this for the Obamacare, it is so misunderstood by so many people at so many different levels, that to enter into something and turn it into a conversation regarding health exchanges, the healthcare exchanges, it is kind of academic at this point. I'm an insurance agent right now. The carrier that I represent no longer carries health insurance. They have sold off their book to another company who, within the past 18 months, has already sold off to yet another company. And in my opinion, by the time this is done and the Obamacare package is fully implemented, we may be down to a handful, meaning a dozen, of national carriers to try and keep this afloat. And you know, I'm obviously, as a Republican, I'm obviously not a big fan of the Obamacare plan. However, I don't think that the average businessman, I don't think that the average resident citizen fully even comprehends what's all in that package. So until we actually get our arms around that, or it's defeated and somebody comes up with you know, whatever the new plan is, I think to talk about anything further from that, further beyond that, really, that's not where the focus should be. Let's get our arms around exactly what this means, because again, the closer we get to 2014, you know, we spoke earlier about jobs. My belief is plugging the hole in the boat before we go looking for new jobs. Stability, predictability. There is no predictability on this Obamacare plan yet because people don't even understand it fully. I'm in the industry, and I don't even consider myself, you know, voiced to the point where I could sit down and give a presentation on it. That's how complicated it is.
Moving to pension reform, the hot topic, in one of the many hot topics in Springfield.
The hottest topic. Are you kidding?
You're right.
this is it. This is the big enchilada. So
yeah. Well, should Illinois pursue a court test of changing the current pensions?
Personally, I think that would not be practical. However, let me couch that. I believe that if we made a promise to all those good, hardworking people that gave their 30 years, whether it be teaching school, plowing snow, fighting fires, if we made a promise to those people constitutionally, then we're obligated to that. However, I might like to find out exactly what that constitutionality included. My understanding and what I'm being led to believe is it was supposed to be a pension. It is not supposed to be a benefits package, which is what I'm understanding it has become. Hey, you get free health insurance, or you get extended this or extended that. No, it was supposed to be a pension. It was supposed to be in lieu of Social Security. Well, how did all this other stuff get added on there? So if there was going to be a challenge, I think the challenge isn't do we pay it or don't we? The challenge is what's included in that payment and what's not.
Okay. And a split system is in progress. Existing employees one level, new employees at another. What additional changes could you see that could be made to help out the pension issue?
It's not enough. There are three groups that need to be addressed here: past, present, and future. And if you know the future, okay, we're on a defined benefit style 401k deal. We all get that. The past, if we're going to honor just the pension portion, that's wonderful. But you know what? Those two items in and of themselves, we're not going to be able to dig our way out of the hole. We're at $86 billion on a conservative day. And I understand that you can say, well, we can manipulate that matrix by saying, what if we went with a different interest rate, or what if we went with a different assumption? And I've looked at those both. And quite honestly, they all come back to $80 billion with a B dollars. We need to look at the present people, and we may need to be very honest with them and say, hey, I understand that up to this point in time, this is what you've had, but since we can't afford to continue it, this is what it's going to be from this point forward. Those present employees may not like the truth that we have to tell them, but if they want any, you know, if we want any chance for this to be viable and alive 10, 15, 20 years from now, we have to make those hard choices. And again, you know, from whatever date backwards, we have to honor it. We made that promise. But from this date forward, in order to keep it solvent and viable, you need to be on a much similar thing to what the new hires are. And that might include freezing the COLA for a while. That might include, you know, for a 5-year period, that might include saying, hey, I'm not sure that everybody should be allowed to get some of these pensions. If you're a part-time employee, I don't know who's part-time in the private sector that gets that. Equally so. In the private sector, we have to work to 65 unless we take, a penalty for retiring early. In the public sector, you can retire at age 55. I think that, that's not equitable. If we move that from 55 up to 65 for the public people, if we take and address those present employees, if we look at the benefits package for the past employees and the future employees are under control, I think we really can make a difference with this. But let me define that. We're still going to have a mortgage on this thing that looks like 15, 20 years, even with the changes that we made. But I would rather know that now and work toward it than continue to run from it like we are.
Okay. Domestic energy. What involvement should Illinois have in addressing domestic energy policy?
I want to be candid with you. I'm not well-versed on this in any way, shape, or form. Not being a politician and not being on the inside circle, I don't have the information that I should on this. I've sat in as much as I can over the past 6 months trying to bring myself up to speed. Illinois seems to be more of a coal-burning state from what I've heard and what I've listened to, and that at this present moment in time, that's not a very popular way to go. We've looked at the bioenergies, and I've tried to bring myself up to speed on that, and we do have an abundance of land. We do have an abundance of farming. Maybe that's a viable alternative. I've looked at the shale boring situation. That's interesting. I'm not convinced of the safety of it yet, but I've certainly listened to 2, 3, 4 different lectures on the subject, and it seems interesting. I worry about the water aquifers that seem to be directly adjacent to that. I've listened to the wind people. Didn't realize that wind generating the wind generation electricity. I didn't realize that doesn't have as far of an extension cord, if you will, on it for that energy to travel or be stored as we might lead to believe. When I travel from my home in Gilbert's down to Springfield, I take Route 39. And when I take 30, I actually drive past you guys in DeKalb and take 39 down, and you see the wind farms there. I didn't realize that those have only a few miles, not 50 miles. You couldn't have those wind turbines and expect them to make it all the way to Rockford to help with power, or all the way into Schaumburg to help with power. And I found that interesting. I don't know what I was thinking. I was expecting that would go a little further. So that's about the extent of what I'm knowing, that's about the extent of what I know right now, what I've been exposed to. But I think that it is vitally important, because when we're talking about jobs for Illinois, the future, we need to be creating situations, and the power plants is where it's going to be. So,
labor management relations. First of all, what's your position on right to work laws?
It's a complicated issue right now, but I do believe that at one point in time, unions absolutely had a place and a point in our country's history. I don't know at this juncture that all of the unions are as helpful and beneficial as we would want them to be. So I'm a little bit stronger toward right to work than I am for continuing some of these old school non-essential unions any longer. And let me give you my basis on this, and I'm going to come to the school district on this because that's my knowledge base. When I meet with these groups of teachers, whether it's 10 teachers in a room or 30 teachers in a room, I can guarantee you that none of them want to be labeled as the problem. They are there to help our children, and I've met the good teachers and I've met the bad teachers. And the good teachers all have one centralized theme. We just want to do our job and do it well. It's the system and the union that they seem to be at odds with. Then I speak with the administrator, who tells me he's at odds with the union. I got a question: at what point does that teacher's union still play the role that we need it to in society? On the flip side of that, I do some work with the local high school and at the booster club level. And I've told this story before, and sometimes it gets old, but we have to put in a batting cage for our baseball team this year. And that batting cage starts out with a flat slab of cement. You know, and that's what the kids will stand on while they're pitching and taking batting lessons. It has, you know, it's all enclosed in a big net and stuff like that. It's very nice. This cement slab on the open market is about $2,500. We turned that into the school system, and the facilities people came back and we said, we're sorry, but unless you're donating that, there's no way that that amount of money is being done by union contractors. And we said, well, you go ahead and have it bid for us and tell us how much money we need to raise to get it done. They came back and told us we'd need over $12,500 to make that happen. You know, when you're on the other side of this trying to raise money to help kids reach their potential, and you're going from $2,500 worth of concrete to $12,000 worth of concrete because you need to follow prevailing wage and union regulations, at that point I think we may have missed the boat a little bit and we need to refocus. And I know that is the most oversimplification in the world, but you know, that's been my exposure to it, and it just gets thicker and thicker and thicker from there.
When it comes to governments and their employee unions, what should the relationship there be?
Interesting question. Give me an example. What I can tell you here, or what I'm gradually being exposed with, is there's so many different groups that are being run by so many different areas that it becomes, when you say government, that's a pretty broad brush there. I've had some involvement at the local level with some of the police departments in some of the smaller communities that are in the 33rd district. And those police officers worked so hard to get the town up to 5,000, 6,000 people, which is a trigger point for them to become autonomous and vote in the unions if they want. The problem has become that they're so small that they didn't get the same union representation that some of the larger towns, you know, in neighboring communities did, and it kind of worked to their detriment rather than to their betterment. And they didn't see that coming. So I think that becomes a component of it. And I know what people look for when they ask this question. Well, are you pro unions or against them? Hey, you know what? I'm pro right to work. I think the unions have had their day, and I think that to some great extent they're standing in our ways. On the other hand, there is some collective strategy that says, listen, if I'm a police officer and I can get shot at and we need to, you know, band together to get the health benefits or other things that we need, that still does make some sense. If I'm a firefighter, that still makes some sense. On the other hand, there's other ways to form those groups now, and you know, so we need to look at it on an individual basis for what it is.
Okay, and then social agenda, just a couple of different issues here.
Sure.
First, how far should the government go in dealing with abortion rights?
I am pro-life. I don't think the government should go very far at all. For me, it's a faith-based answer. You know, for me, this isn't there isn't a question to this. And I know that there's a moral and philosophical debate on this. There's not for me. Mine is faith-based. My wife and I have a story. I don't know where to go from there. And I don't mind sharing the story, nor do I believe my wife. My wife and I, you know, met in college, fell in love, got married. We've been together 21 years. Unfortunately, right after we got married, we weren't able to carry children all the way to birth. We had three or four miscarriages, some corrective uterine surgery, blah, 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 blah. By the time our third child was born, my wife was a little older, and we had a doctor come to us and say, hey, listen, this is very simple. Please know that at your age and with the complications that we've had carrying the term, you know what, there's a test that we can do to let you know if this baby's okay or not. I was mortified. I was flabbergasted. I remember standing in that doctor's office feeling like the most naive person in the world, saying, what do you mean? That's not a choice for me. That's a question that's left for a higher power, and that's not a question that I should be allowed to make in my life. So, you know, that's not a decision I should be allowed to make in my life, or a question I should answer. So I mean,
last year civil unions passed and were made legal in Illinois, and this year there's talk about same-sex marriage. Where do you stand on those?
Marriage is between a man and a woman, and again, that's a faith-based decision for me.
Okay. And moving to the second most exciting thing going on in Springfield is just talk about the state's debt and the deficit and what to do financially to try to, you know, make things better financially for Illinois. What do you see as the best approach to that?
Zero-based budgeting. We have two large sacks of potatoes that are sitting on our back right now. One of them is $86 billion in debt from the pension system. The other one is the Medicaid system, which is running $10 to $15 billion in debt. We need to call those out for what they are. You know, public enemy number one and number two. If we can address those, get those, and again, understand, addressing them means we might need to put a mortgage on these things for 15, 20 years, but if we can fix it and know that that's what it's going to take, then let's just get to it. If we can get those two under control, then we need to look at the budget process and say it's not about raising revenues, because people are revenued out right now. We are so uncompetitive against the other states that to even say we're going to raise more, no, we can't. We'll have nobody else to live here or work here. We need to look at the spending side. It's that simple. And the spending starts by looking at a zero-based budgeting, a grant-style writing. You know, I think the days of saying we need 3% from you and 3% from you and 8% from you, and if we all do that, we'll have this thing turned around in 5 years. I don't believe that for a second. I think we need to look at these programs and say, how efficient is your program compared to yours? And more importantly, have you stayed within numbers? Are you staying current? Are you using technology? And then why should we put yours, you know, let's just say there's 100 line items. Why should yours be number one versus number 99? And what's the most important for us? You know, obviously to me, I believe education is, you know, makes the top of the list, you know, as we discussed earlier. So I believe it's a totally cultural shift in how we go about doing things and the way we look at it.
Okay. And what sets you apart as the best choice for this nomination?
You know what? For me, this is simple. We live right now in some very extraordinary times, and Springfield is a mess. And for me, I come unencumbered. Now, some people might look at that and say, so you don't have the experience? You're right. I don't have the experience. But right now, I believe that that's what's needed. I believe that we need somebody who can stand up to the leadership of both parties, earnestly raise his hand in the air and say, excuse me, I don't get it. How is that in the best interest of the people of Illinois? And how is that going to make it within our goals of getting back on budget, making government smaller, and making it work for the people like it used to? I don't believe that the career politicians that we've had that have been down there for the time that they have, you know, have any better plans right now than they did 5 years ago. And someone new, someone fresh, someone willing to say enough is enough. You know, we need to make the hard decisions and be able to stand up without a lobbyist group or a special interest group or again, I use the word encumbrance. Without those relationships, to stand up and say, excuse me, I just don't get it. How is that in the best interest of the people, whether that's the red team or the blue team? Because although I am running on the Republican platform and I am hardcore Republican, I don't believe that we've done the best job that we can.
Okay. And then last of all, any other issues you see as important to the district and to the state?
You know, I think that we've covered enough for you know, a major interview here, but right now, you know, ethics are the biggest, you know, when I walked the district, and I'm going to try and be specific on this, when I walked the district, and I've probably knocked on at least 4,000, 5,000 doors at this time between the petition drive and passing out literature, my job is to be the voice of the people. It's not what Cliff wants. It's not what Cliff Sturgis wants. It's what the people want Cliff Sturgis to do for them. And the one cry that I heard time and time again was, Cliff, we don't trust anybody down there anymore. The public trust has been eroded through whatever. We've got two governors that have gone to jail back to back. You know, we've got corruption in the Medicaid system that's so large. You know, we've got pension padding that's reached epidemic proportions. You know what? I got people when I knocked on the door and said, why would you want to go do this? And my response is always, you know what? So you don't fight the fight? This is our home. This is where we live. We are burdening our children and grandchildren with debt. It is time for us to stand up and make some of the hard choices, but restoring the public trust and telling the truth, far and away, the single most unanimous thing that I've heard. And that starts with cultural shifts. That starts with ethics. You know, that starts with personal responsibility at every individual's level.